This is
KUT.
KUT, Austin.
Stop.
This is KUT Weekend for the second weekend of October 2018. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Nathan Bernier with KUT 90.5, the NPR station in Austin, Texas. Here's what we got for you this week. A local ballot initiative that has Austin environmentalists divided.
If Proposition J passes, then the voters will have the right to check the council's work.
The fact is, you know, the city is growing. We can't build a wall around it.
Dockless electric scooters making their debut at the Austin City Limits Music Festival.
Really pairs well, I think, with these large events where you can't get automobiles.
And the consequences of partisan media bubbles.
When political actors can't agree on basic facts and procedures, compromise and rule-bound argumentation are basically impossible.
Those stories and more in this edition of KUT Weekend. It's not always easy to be an environmentalist in Austin. It's a deep red state that we live in, not known for its eco-friendly regulations. But one thing that Austin environmental groups rarely worry about is each other. That is until recently. As KUT's Mose Bushell reports, Proposition J is a ballot initiative up this November that has divided the city's green community.
Basically, Prop J would require that any comprehensive change to Austin's land use rules go to voters for approval. As such, it would slow down big picture rezoning in one of the country's fastest growing cities. Opponents say that would hinder smart growth and hogtie efforts to fight gentrification. People in favor of Prop J say exactly the opposite. They say it will allow Austin voters to confront those challenges. This story will focus specifically on what Prop J means for the environment. And to understand that, you need to know that the fight over Prop J is a continuation of a fight over urban density, a fight that played out citywide in the debate over Code Next. That was the failed attempt to rewrite the rules governing what can be built where in Austin. It's also something we reported on a lot. Remember?
Comments on the current draft of Code Next need to be submitted by midnight.
Right, so backing up just a little bit, Code Next is the city's process of rewriting its land development code.
Does this sound familiar? Yes, we're talking about Code Next.
Code Next is a train wreck.
There was a lot of that.
Austin Mayor Steve Adler posted to the city council message board. He asked if the current process was, quote, poisoned.
Council members voted to scrap Code Next and to restart the process of updating Austin's land development code.
That's kind of it in a nutshell. Code Next would have allowed denser development in some parts of town. A lot of people said it didn't go far enough. A lot of other people said it went too far. Eventually, the fight just got too fierce for Austin City Council. So earlier this year, the mayor, who's running for re-election, announced that the city was putting the brakes on Code Next, but not before Code Next opponents had put Prop J on the ballot as a way of heading off the next Code Next.
If Proposition J passes, then the voters will have the right to check the council's work if we resurrect Code Next and we have a comprehensive rewrite of our land development code.
That's Bill Bunch. He's head of the Save Our Springs Alliance, one of Austin's most well-known environmental groups. He was opposed to Code Next. One reason? He didn't like the added density it would have brought to central Austin. He says he's not opposed to density in itself.
But the place to do that is on Greenfield's development. So you do it right at the front end, rather than try to scrape our central city neighborhoods and force it on top of existing communities.
So Code Next would have meant more density. Passing Prop J would likely prevent more density. This is what's divided environmentalists.
It's weird to point out disagreements among your friends.
This is Luke Metzger. He runs Environment Texas, another Austin-based group, and he opposes Prop J.
The fact is, you know, the city is growing. We can't build a wall around it. So we have to plan for this growth. And the question is, are we going to increase sprawl, increase traffic, or are we going to find a way to, you know, do it in a much more walkable, transit-friendly way and bring people into the urban core?
In part, you can boil these two views down to changing attitudes over what it means to be an environmentalist. After all, there are a lot of different ways to care about the earth.
What would you say is the most pressing environmental issue right now?
There's too many to choose from.
To hear a few, our intrepid intern Elizabeth Uklis walked around town asking people what they thought.
Bees.
She got all sorts of different answers.
Air pollution, definitely.
But there's one that sticks out as the most daunting.
The most pressing?
The one that just this week, scientists at the UN told us threatens everything.
The weather.
It's climate change.
Pure and simple, the weather. It's out of control. I mean, I don't know what else to say.
In a way, the battle over Prop J is part of a larger debate over how environmentalists are responding to climate change.
You know, I think what you're seeing now in Texas can be copied and pasted into not just California, but I think across the country.
David Garcia is with the Turner Center for Housing Innovation at UC Berkeley. He says global warming has forced some environmentalists who've traditionally opposed development to rethink that.
Is that acceptable to achieve this broader goal of creating more housing in dense urban areas that will create better outcomes for the environment?
To fight climate change. Now, among people who look at this for a living, there's basically a consensus, says Professor Kara Cockleman. She's a transportation engineer at UT Austin.
It's not controversial for researchers. It's controversial for Americans.
Basically, density fights global warming by reducing energy use. And that, of course, reduces greenhouse gas emissions.
So just the transportation distances and the ability to walk and bike, that saves a lot of energy right there. And then, of course, having smaller homes and businesses and sharing walls and ceilings saves a lot of energy inside.
But opponents point out that dense development can lead to increased flood risk, hurt the urban tree canopy, and might cause some houses to be torn down and replaced unnecessarily.
I don't really see that as a fair argument.
Here's David Garcia again.
We know that, you know, just because you don't build the housing that's in demand, it's going to be built probably somewhere. And if you're not allowing it in closer in neighborhoods, more than likely it's going to be pushed to a more suburban location where you have greater environmental consequences overall.
But here's the catch. There are plenty of things that we know are good for the environment, but we just don't want to do them. And in Austin, more central city density might just be one of them. Part of it goes back to what some call neighborhood character. It's a non-negotiable position among a lot of people in Austin that single-family neighborhoods in the central city are just crucial to Austin's identity. And those folks say passing Prop J would help protect that identity. Here's Bill Bunch again.
Some of the environmental community thought, no, it's fine. We've got to say we're getting rid of single-family neighborhoods.
Personally, could you see an example where your vision of good environmental stewardship ran counter to what, you know, Austin neighborhoods would want?
I mean, there might be some small play somewhere.
But he says that would be an exception, while others, like Luke Metzger with Environment Texas, are more comfortable opposing Prop J and advocating for duplexes and apartments in some parts of town where you now see yards and bungalows. Mose Bouchel, KT News.
The Diocese of Austin and every other Catholic diocese in Texas will make public the names of clergy they say have been credibly accused of abuse. As KUT's Trey Shaw reports, Catholic leaders in Texas will hire a third party to assess that credibility.
The Austin Diocese and the 15 others in Texas say the names will date back at least as far as 1950. Bishop Joe S. Vasquez of the Austin Diocese says parishioners have been calling for this kind of accountability and transparency.
And so our hope was, by releasing names, we will contribute to healing and to restoring trust.
Bishop Vasquez says he hopes it's also a way to acknowledge and apologize for what has happened.
It's one way for the church to express contrition, sorrow, asking for forgiveness of those who have been abused by a cleric.
Each diocese in Texas plans to release the names by the end of January 2019. They're asking people with knowledge of abuse, past or present, to come forward. Trey Shar, KUT News.
Anti-abortion groups in Texas say they are cautiously optimistic now that Brett Kavanaugh has a seat on the U.S. Supreme Court. KUT's Ashley Lopez reports the groups are considering their next steps under a court that is more conservative and more likely to uphold anti-abortion legislation.
John Segoe with Texas Right to Life says Kavanaugh's appointment means a big hurdle in his effort to roll back abortions in the state is now gone. But he says that doesn't mean abortion is going to be eliminated overnight.
Just because there are you know, more conservative justices on the court doesn't mean the fundamental nature of the court has changed.
Segoe says the court doesn't make political statements and doesn't change major legal precedent from one day to the next. He says that's why his focus will be to pass laws in Texas that get at specific legal questions and slowly get the court to back off on past decisions upholding abortion rights in the U.S.
You know, it's on the responsibility of the states to pass prudent and dynamic legislation to bring up those right questions to move the court slowly in the right direction.
Not all anti-abortion activists feel that way, though. Segoe says some groups want state lawmakers to pass sweeping bans on abortion during the next legislative session that will directly challenge Roe v. Wade. Segoe worries laws like that, however, could still backfire if they go before the Supreme Court. Ashley Lopez, KUT News.
The city of Austin is moving forward with an effort to buy the site of a segregation-era school in East Austin. As KUT's Saida Hassan reports, the property owner is criticizing the move.
Developer Austin Stowell bought the site of the old Montopolis School in 2015 and made plans to build new housing there. That led to a public battle over preserving the schoolhouse. During segregation, the now vacant building was one of 42 schools for black children throughout Travis County. This past June, the Austin City Council voted to consider taking the property through eminent domain. Stowell recently spoke about the city's action at an event hosted by the Texas Public Policy Foundation.
It seems like a strikingly unfair process. Our goal is to preserve it and to do it in a respectful manner, privately, and not do it on the backs of the taxpayers of Austin just so that certain politicians locally can have a political win.
The city plans to continue the eminent domain process at a special hearing in the coming months. Saida Hassan, KUT News.
Austin City Limits Music Festival starts the second of its two-weekend run today, Friday. But before you can fight your way to the front of the stage, you have to figure out how to get to Zilker Park. KUT's Jimmy Moss reports on the Dockless Scooter's first chance to wade into ACL's alternative transportation pool.
Outside Zilker Park last weekend, scooters lined the large parking lot near Zach Scott Theater. Runners for Bird and Lime, the two largest dockless providers in Austin, were picking up scooters abandoned closer to the front gates and running them from Barton Springs to Toomey Road.
We've actually had an incredible ridership.
Joe Desitel is manager of community affairs for Lime.
And so it really pairs well, I think, with these large events where you can't get automobiles. And so people are looking for all kinds of alternatives to get to these festivals, and certainly scooters have been one of those.
But with every new alternative to get to ACL, there's a new logistical puzzle.
When you look at 75,000 people being located in the same area, you really have to think about logistics a lot, and both in terms of when they're coming into the festival, but also egress and how that works when everybody's trying to leave that area all at the same time. And so we really spent weeks working with the city and other dockless providers to work together to create the overall best experience possible, given the logistical difficulties.
Even with all that planning, there were more 311 complaints about the scooters reported last weekend over previous ones. A Bird spokesperson said in a statement that the company will, quote, be closely monitoring our fleet throughout the duration of the event to support the safety and advancement of our Austin riders and community. Also outside ACL, on Barton Springs, you'll find the older alternative mode of transport, the parade of pedicab operators shuttling people to and from the fest. On the surface, you might think they would feel the sting of the scooter's arrival the most. A pedicab operator named Lamar sits atop his cab waiting for customers to leave Sunday night. He wouldn't give his last name, but he says for him, business is up this year over last ACL.
It's better because there's less cabs. Cabs have quit because of the scooters, so they haven't shown up.
So the scooters are not taking pedicab business at ACL because the scooters have already forced many of the city's pedicab drivers to quit. According to the city's transportation department, the number of pedicab permits have been capped at 500. There has been no drop in the number of permits that have been given out. But anecdotally, from operators like Austin Pedicab and those on Barton Springs Sunday night, the real numbers are down by roughly 25%. Still, many here shrug off the scooters.
I would say, like, it doesn't really affect me personally. I think that Austin's kind of inaccessible the way it's laid out, so I'm happy to see that people have more transportation options.
Joey has driven a pedicab around for 6 years. This is her fourth ACL, and also would not give her last name.
Like, the biased pedicabber in me is like, sometimes like, oh, I wish you'd take a pedicab ride, but I'm happy that they can get around.
And in a town struggling to figure out the best way to fight traffic, maybe that's the best thing we can all hope for. Jimmy Moss, KUT News.
A new public opinion survey by Quinnipiac University suggests that U.S. Senator Ted Cruz is leading by 9 points in his re-election battle against Democratic Congressman Beto O'Rourke. Joining us to talk about it is KUT's senior editor, Ben Philpott. Hello, Ben.
Hello.
How do we look at this poll, Ben? Help me understand. What does it mean?
I think one way you can look at this poll is that it is absolutely showing the effects of the blue wave. People are like, wait a minute, he's 9 points back. How is that a blue wave? Well, in this same poll, it shows Governor Greg Abbott is up 20 points on former Dallas County Sheriff Lupe Valdez, who's running as a Democrat for the governor's seat. 20 points. So it goes from 20 points to 9 points. That's the wave.
And other polls have shown a similar pattern, right?
Right. Other polls have shown a very similar pattern, about 20 points or, 15 to 20 points for the governor's race, the spread there, and, between 5 and 9 points for the Senate race. And then there are a bunch of congressional races across the state that are also much closer than what we have seen over the last two decades. But this is a very red state. And cutting into that lead by 11 points is what O'Rourke is doing, and yet it still isn't enough because of the structural advantage that Republicans have in this state.
Anything in this poll that would suggest the Senate race in Texas could tighten over the next couple of weeks? I mean, early voting starts in a week from Monday. Anything to suggest it could get closer between O'Rourke and Cruz?
Well, I think it's going to be about who O'Rourke is able to get to the polls. That structural advantage that I talked about that Republicans have, that is with likely voters. Likely voters in Texas, more of them vote Republican than Democrat, and that's just the way it is. Now, Texas is, of course, a low voter participation state. So the likely voters lean Republican, more than lean Republican, definitely go for Republicans. And it's going to be whether or not O'Rourke can bring unlikely voters, new voters, the younger voters out to the polls. There are plenty of people that don't vote in this state to close that gap. It's whether or not the O'Rourke campaign or any of the Democrats up and down the ballot can turn unlikely and never voted before voters into people that show up on election day.
If O'Rourke loses by 2 points, it's still a loss. He still loses. Senator Cruz remains senator. But if he loses by 2 points, if he loses by 5 points, could that help down ballot congressional races that you mentioned where they're not 9 points apart? Maybe they're 4 points apart.
Yeah, I think it absolutely would. I think that you would see that kind of statewide support filtering down, especially if you have a high percentage of people voting straight party ticket, which this is the last election that you can do that here in Texas. At the very top of the ballot, you can say Democrat or Republican, and all of those races will automatically be filled out. So absolutely, a 2-point race, even if it's a loss for Beto O'Rourke, should provide some surprises down ballot, both at congressional level and at state house and maybe even state senate level. Now, don't ask me to predict a surprise because, that's just too hard.
Can you please predict a surprise, Ben?
Yes. Surprise, I'm not going to answer. No. Okay. I mean, I think you in Central Texas, you would look to things like the seat that Lamar Smith is retiring from with Chip Roy, the Republican, and the Democrat, Joseph Kopser. More of a surprise might be things like the M.J. Hager, the Democrat running against Republican incumbent John Carter in Williamson County Congressional District, Williamson and Bell County. Even at the statehouse level, you've got a couple of seats in the Travis County, Williamson County area that are currently held by Republicans that a really close top of the ticket race could flip them to the Democrats.
KUT senior editor Ben Philpott talking to us about a new Quinnipiac University poll that finds U.S. Senator Ted Cruz with a 9-point lead over his Democratic challenger, Congressman Beto O'Rourke. Ben, thank you so much.
Thank you.
State Fair of Texas is underway in Dallas, and people are flocking through the gates to try crazy fried foods, watch a dog stunt show, spin around on those midway rides, maybe sample some Texas wines. But there are also agricultural competitions. People from around the state and beyond compete in shows for sheep, goats, cows, even llamas. Dallas Public Radio reporter Miguel Perez roamed the fairgrounds as exhibitors, young and old, tended to their prized animals. Let's hear from some of them. We'll start with Joe Castillo, who traveled with his family from Denver City in far west Texas to show goats.
It's been a long night. We've been in the truck all night. We drove 6 hours, and we spent the night in the truck until this morning, and then we'll go get some sleep here in a little bit. I have a niece here helping her out. We've been getting ready for about a week now. Just for this, just to come up here for today and tomorrow. Clipping their hair, their hooves, making sure their skin and hair is all nice and soft. We put lotions on their coat so they're not too dry. Her big goat is called Mocha, and it's hard to leave him here once we're done with them. It's hard.
Hi, I'm Mackenzie Ince. I am 12 years old, and I'm from Sweetwater, Texas. We feed them certain items that we buy, and we work them around like a walker, a treadmill. We set up a cage around it, and they set their front feet on top, and they walk backwards to build muscle. You have to get to know your lamb to know how to set them up, show them. My mom used to show, and so did my dad, so I get a lot of tricks from them.
My name is Michael Lee. I'm 48. I'm from Flower Mound, Texas. What we're doing at the fair today is showing goats. They have to be clean and trimmed. They look for color markings. They like the horns burned off of the females. And mostly they look for definition of the body, the build, the barrel, the breasts, wide in the front legs, you know, kind of flat on top. They don't steal from you, cheat, or lie. The more you learn about goats, the more you like them. She's hungry. She wants cookies.
Hi, my name is Lauren Bochick. I'm 12 years old and from Waller, Texas. I just got really interested in Brahman cattle. We always passed them going down the highway seeing Dietering Brahmins. And when I finally turned 8, I begged my parents to get me a Brahman. And ever since, I've just clicked with them. Here they are. We have Gucci, Pixie, Trixie, and 511. She doesn't really have like an attitude like the other one, but if on a good day she's Shelby, so Shelby or 511. People are always like, well, what's the hump and all the extra skin and the big ears for? Well, the hump, it's just a mean muscle, and it's fat and a muscle, and did you know that you can actually eat the hump? It's very tender, and it's better than Wagyu meat. It's very expensive, but it's very good, I've heard. These animals, it's what promotes our world, and cows produce milk, and that's like one of the main forces that everything is made with, and I think people should appreciate them more.
My name's Alicia Smith, and we are from Roy City, Texas. As far as the goats, we have 24 goats at home. We raise them, breed them, and then show them mainly. I have 2 girls. They're 10 and 7, so we do it all together. I think that most people don't know anything about this, and I think they come to the fair for the food and the rides, and I think this is just kind of an afterthought. A lot of kids have never even seen a goat or don't know what a cow is or, you know, don't know that milk comes from a cow. Don't, you know, a lot of that stuff. So I think that's awesome that we're able to teach.
The voices of competitors at the State Fair of Texas Livestock Show in Dallas. The State Fair runs through October 21st. People in Texas can start casting ballots in the November election in a week from next Monday, October 22nd. That's the first day of early voting in the state. It's coming up fast. And the election comes as people are increasingly divided about whether they can trust the news media to deliver them the information to inform their vote. We see it in Texas. We see it on the national level. A recent poll of more than 5,000 adults by the Pew Research Center
showed strong divisions between Republicans and Democrats when it comes to support of the news media's watchdog role, perceived fairness in political coverage, trust in information from both national and local news organizations. So if we cannot agree on who's accurately representing the truth, how can we continue to exist as a democracy? That's a question that our next guest has spent a lot of time considering. Brooke Gladstone is the host of On the Media, which you can hear Sunday mornings at 10 on KUT. Hi, Brooke.
Hi.
Your most recent book is called The Trouble with Reality. It kind of addresses these issues. What is the trouble with reality?
Well, what I sought out in the little book to answer is, why was the distress over the election of Donald Trump in the more than half of the country that didn't vote for him, why was that so intense? And what were we feeling that made us so much more upset than we have been when other presidents that we didn't want were voted into office? And what I discovered, or what I surmised ultimately, is that it was reality itself that was the cause of the distress, that it didn't turn out to be what we expected. The world isn't what those of us who voted against Donald Trump thought it was. Democracy doesn't work the way we thought it was. Our country isn't what we thought it was. A lot of the basic principles on which we built our individual realities, and each one of us has our very own reality, was not what we thought. And there was a big smash up of realities on this political highway. And now everyone is walking through the shards, figuring out how to tape them back together.
I think many Trump supporters would agree with you and say that's exactly the problem, is that liberals had their version of reality and imposed it upon society through the media and news organizations. How can those viewpoints be reconciled if people can't agree on a basic set of assumptions about the outcomes of policy?
Right. I think you're absolutely right that democracy isn't going to function very well if we don't all draw from the same pool of facts. I was reading this piece in Think Progress by Ned Reznikoff, who said, when political actors can't agree on basic facts and procedures, compromise and rule-bound argumentation are basically impossible. Politics reverts back to its natural state as a raw power struggle in which the weak are dominated by the strong. And I think you're also absolutely right when you say the people that voted for Trump felt that they had been ignored, that they had a rising sense of alarm, and that it wasn't being addressed by the Democrats that were getting voted into office. And in fact, they'd show up and make promises and take off and forget that they existed for 4 years. Meanwhile, their problems got worse and worse. This is a fair argument. I think that they're the one way around it, without saying, I'm going to believe some of what you believe if you believe some of what I believe. Because I don't think that's going to happen. I don't think we're wired that way. But we can listen. We can empathize or put ourselves in someone else's shoe. We can contextualize where their beliefs, whether or not we share them, where those beliefs come from, and thereby begin to solve the underlying problems in a way that doesn't compromise either of our beliefs. I really think that's possible.
So I guess what I want to know from you then is, how do you go about doing that on a day-to-day level in a practical way?
What we could do is try and lower our own degree of rage in these days of rage. That's the best that we can hope for. And I think we can do that by, when we're having a strong feeling, simply acknowledging, oh, I'm having an emotion here, and neither try to justify it or make it go away, but just let it pass and calm down. So many of the emotions that we have got nothing to do with what's going on right now, but we are triggered endlessly. So if we understand that these are triggers and not necessarily the substance that's causing these emotions. I know this sounds like, oh, you know.
It sounds like my dad talking about Buddhism.
Yes, and actually that's where I'm drawing it from, because I honestly feel that those of us who are just individuals and not serving in our state houses or local congresses can still fight for what we believe. And as individuals, simply to try and understand that everyone does live in their own world and lower the level of rage, tick down the level of tribalism so that we can just hear each other. I'm not saying compromise. I'm not even saying change each other's mind, because I'm going to go back to the point that I think it's possible to find solutions without compromising either of our fundamental beliefs. Not all solutions, but a few. And one solution may lead to another.
The pushback against what you just said, lower the rage level and be observant of what is triggering emotions within us, is that that risks then normalizing.
No, I knew you were going to say that. Normalizing means making something acceptable. You don't keep something abnormal by responding with rage when it comes up every single time. In fact, then the rage becomes normal. You're not normalizing the offense, you're normalizing rage.
Brooke Gladstone is the host of On the Media, which you can listen to Sunday mornings at 10 here on KUT. Her most recent book is called The Trouble with Reality. Brooke, thanks so much for talking to us.
Thanks, Nathan.
Is KUT Weekend for the second weekend of October 2018. You can subscribe to this podcast at weekend.kut.org and email any questions or comments to weekend@kut.org or just ask me on Twitter. I'm at KUT Nathan. Our theme music is by RAC. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Nathan Bernier with KUT 90.5 and KUT.org.